Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Grace Bonney of After the Jump, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, and welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Renee Erickson. So first question is, what does the Puget Sound sound like?
It sounds like, I guess, a lot of tugboats and horns and tides.
Yeah, it's a different, it's waterway traffic. It's not like what we have here in New York.
No, not it's gridlock. Definitely not like New York.
But you grew up on the Puget Sound.
I grew up in Woodinville, which is the east side of what we call the east side of Seattle. But I spent my summers on the Puget Sound, yeah. So we would stay on the Tulalip Indian Reservation in a shack, and we would fish and crab and clam and hang out on the beach.
So what you do now has always been a part of your life, living on the water, fishing for, you know, the most pristine seafood that you can get.
For sure, yeah. We would spend a lot of time crabbing and fishing in the summer. My father was a good fisherman, and he would, after some encouragement, took me out as well. But yeah, we ate a lot of crab, and I am happy to say I love it now much more than I did as a child.
What was it about, you know, crab as a kid that you were a little
volume
wary of?
Yeah, crab every day, every meal. You know, it's great, but it was, you know, when you're eight and you want to eat Captain Crunch and you get crab salad and crab on toast or crab quiche, you know, it's decadent and fabulous. But you know, I think even now, if I ate crab every day, I would probably be pretty tired of it.
Well, what institute? I mean, what is crabbing? I picture the waiters, but I don't know.
It's so easy.
After that.
Yeah. It's like, you know, beer in a cooler and a boat.
That's first and foremost.
Yeah, right? Beer in a cooler. And yeah, it's super, you know, when we crabbed as kids, we had star traps, which were traps that were flat on the ground, and you would pull them up really fast and try to trap the crabs. Now we have traps that are a little more, you know, efficient and easier. So the crabs go in, they can get out eventually. There's that terrible idea of losing your trap and having it full of crab, but you pull it up and it's, you know, it's chock full of crab, hopefully, and you sort through them all and keep the ones that are legal and throw the rest ones back. So it's not hard.
Excellent. One day I will come out and go crabbing.
I will take you crabbing for sure.
And I will bring the beer. you know, it's great and all to talk about, you know, fish and seafood and that aspect of your life. But what I found most fascinating is, you know, you went to school for printmaking.
Printmaking and painting.
I mean, so were those parallel paths? Were you interested in the food aspect, fishing aspect of things, or were you more so striving?
Did
for
I paint
artistic?
Boats?
Yeah.
no, I thought I would be an artist and probably more of a teacher of art, and that was, you know, sort of what I had set out to do. I went to art school at the University of Washington and went to school in Rome. They have a building in Rome on the Campo dei Fiori, and spent a semester there, and that was sort of the place, you know, in my life where I stopped and paid attention to food in a way that I hadn't. In that, you know, it was a daily thought process for people. Like, they were planning on what they were going to eat. It wasn't, you know, a fridge full of food that you kind of sorted through and made dinner out of. It was amazing. You know, you would walk through the market and you'd pass the butcher and the ravioli maker and the fish store and the lady that only sold porcinis, and it was, you know, mind-blowing, really, to go from, like, you know, a grocery store in America as a kid to seeing something that had been that way forever, I think, really, how people thought about food in a different way. And a lot of it, I think, is just, you know, they don't probably have a freezer in their basement and, you know, enormous refrigerator where they store everything. So the way that people thought about food in Italy just sort of changed my idea about cooking and what mattered, I guess, in a way. I still thought I was going to be an artist and a teacher, but ended up working in Bowood Street and, you know, sort of fell in love with restaurants more than elementary school children that, yeah, I thought I would teach. So it was a good career shift for sure.
I mean, back to Rome, what were some of the dishes that you remember that kind of resonated with you?
I mean, a lot of it, I think, is something that I naturally, or, you know, I don't know naturally, but end up really having an affinity to, is just simple preparations of things and just really paying attention to the ingredient. I remember the Porcini lady, or couple actually, and they had their little stand at the corner near where my school entrance was, and they were there maybe only on Fridays or so, I don't know. They were there one day a week, and they had this insane pile of mushrooms, and I was so excited I was going to go buy some mushrooms, and I thought, you know, I'll just buy four, and, you know, not knowing that they were going to cost me, like, I don't know, it was going to be like $80 in mushrooms at the time, and I was like wide-eyed, and I bought one, and we, I don't even remember what we did with it. I think we just like sauteed it in olive oil and garlic, and but I think just like walking around and seeing, like, you know, escarole and all the lettuces that they served with, you know, really simple shaved Parmesan, you know, what you still expect to see when you go there, but it's so good, you know, the flavors are so correct, you know, seasonally correct and delicious. And I think, you know, when you're in a place that is about, you know, Italian food, in Rome, you know, a lot of anchovies, a lot of, tripe, garlic, all those sort of dishes, you sort of crave that and want that. And so I think, you know, that, not that I'm in a place that has that specific of a style of food, I think seafood is one of them, as well as just being really seasonally appropriate, has been something that has kind of transferred into how I think about food for sure.
So, I mean, with this affinity towards food and cooking, I mean, you never went to culinary school.
Nope.
How did you land at Boat Street
in Seattle? I, you know, I literally drove by it needing a job and thought it was charming and interesting, and stopped in, and a woman, her name's Seema Prasad, who I went to high school with, was managing it, so to speak. I mean, we were both really young and kind of clueless, so it was fun to walk in and be like, I need a job, and it's someone I knew. So she hired me with pretty much no reason to hire me. And I started serving and didn't really love it. And so I just asked if I could work in the kitchen. So I learned to prep, you know, like anyone does, and bake and do all sorts of kind of all the fill-in kind of work. And just, you know, after time, I got, you know, was able to become, you know, more part of the kitchen. So I learned more and I cooked more. And then eventually I was running it. I mean, it was a, you know, it's a restaurant that was, you know, uncommon in that I think the opportunities that were available were not traditional. You know, like, I don't think I could have done that sort of experience. Isn't standard. I don't believe in a restaurant where you can, like, you know, walk in and then be like, oh, I'm going to cook on the line. You know, like, you have to do some time before that happens. But I lucked out and eventually bought it. So it was sort of a, you know, again, not your standard story, but I'm really thrilled it was mine.
Yeah, I mean, but you educated yourself in a different way through Julia Child, through Elizabeth David. I mean, how did reading those books, reading, you know, those recipes help you as a cook?
You know, I think their honesty towards making decisions about food and sort of their attention to tradition and simplicity, like, you know, one of my favorite recipes is a strawberry jam recipe in Elizabeth David, where it's just like strawberries, sugar, cook till done. You know, it's like there's nothing there. It's this really hysterical, you know, no help. But, you know, I think, you know, their attempt to, or her attempt to, you know, encourage the cook to interact with what they're doing rather than having someone be like, in 20 minutes, you know, put it in the freezer and check it and make sure, you know, there's all that sort of like handholding. And she's just like, you know, I got other things to tell you about. So, yeah, I think, you know, I'm not a trained cook in that regard. So I don't have, you know, every trick up my sleeve or anything. And so I'm definitely more of a kind of pay attention and see how things go and react to it rather than like have a exact plan.
Yeah. I love how the book, a boat, a walrus, and a whale opens up with Boat Street cream scones.
Yeah.
And the blackberry jam. Two very simple but very particular recipes. Mm-hmm. I know I've made scones before and they've turned out terribly.
Sure. Most of them do.
Yeah. But I mean, what was that hand-holding? What was that... You learned about how to make the best scone possible, how to make the best blackberry jam.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know that they're the best. I think they're good. They're fantastic. I think, you know, I think one, making a scone with cream really kind of helps you out a lot. I think it gives a lot more moisture and richness to the scone, where sometimes they can be really dry and crumbly and not that lovely. And then, you know, I'm from Seattle, so blackberries are abundant, and to not include that as an option for jam is sort of absurd. They grow wild everywhere, and you can pick, you know, pounds of them, and they're incredible. They're something that I think is really, and, you know, something that we spent, you know, we picked blackberries forever, and froze them and kept them around. So they're, you know, it's just part of being a Seattle girl.
Yeah. How fertile the land is in Seattle. It's amazing because going out there, you know, there's this idea of it always being rainy. It always being right. Foggy. I mean, that's not true.
No, we lie to everyone.
Yeah. I'm sorry to dispel that. And, yeah. You know, but it's not true. It's stunning. It's beautiful. I went during July one year where it's just sun and you know, everything's green and you know, flush.
It's a magical place. I mean, I think the weather isn't, you know, it's, you know, it's still the Northwest. So we definitely have a good fair amount of rain, but I think what people assume is that it's really cold and really rainy all the time. And, you know, we're on the coast, so weather changes all the time. And, you know, and we have a proper spring where it's, you know, sunny and beautiful and then pouring down rain and then summer comes and we have about three solid, hopefully four sometimes months of, you know, 70 to 90 degrees. So it's super, super mild for summer weather. There's hardly any humidity. But yeah, it's pretty fantastic. And then we have the mountains. So we're kind of trapped between these perfect environments.
Trapped.
Yeah. Happily. Yeah. So we have the Cascades and the Olympics and then the Puget Sound and the ocean. So we've got all you need.
It's not a bad place.
And a desert, which you grow amazing tomatoes in. So it's a great spot.
And, you know, aside from crabbing while younger, were you surrounded by all these things? Were you picking blueberries as a child, or was this a more culinary venture?
No, we had a farm. I mean, a garden. In Woodinville, when I was growing up, it was very different than it is now. Now it's, you know, strip malls and wineries everywhere. And at that point we had 2.5 acres and my dad was a landscaper. So he had a lot of trees and things planted. We had a lot of fruit trees and, we had a garden and we grew, you know, everything, beans, tomatoes, carrots. One of my chores was to weed the garden. And there's many stories that my mother will tell of me eating more than weeding. But, we spent a lot of time, you know, growing things. You know, we also had, you know, the same sort of casseroles and all the other junk that we made in the 80s and 70s. But there was a lot of really great food in our family, for sure. You know, I remember, I mean, the beach is the most kind of vivid memories of food. Mostly, I think, because we, you know, it was harvested and we would go fishing and get to, you know, gut a fish and wait to grill it. And yeah, it's idyllic for sure to be able to do that as a child. And even now, you know, like I feel really fortunate to be able to go crabbing and fishing and actually catch things. Fishing's tough. It's not easy to do. So crabbing is where it's super rewarding because you can really, you know, count on coming back with some dinner.
Yeah. And you have that beer.
Yeah, and you have Rainier. Yep, for sure.
Excellent. We're going to take a quick break, come back, talk about pickles, oyster, wood fire, and so much more.
Perfect.
You can listen to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Washed rind cheeses are a fairly recent addition to the repertoires of artisanal cheesemakers in the United States. These cheeses tend to be stinkier than other types and are often high on the list of connoisseurs. Now, Whole Foods Market has come up with one of their own. The raw cow's milk cheese, made by Sprout Creek Farm in Poughkeepsie, New York, is washed with 6-point ale from Red Hook, Brooklyn. The beige sticky rind deepens in color as it ages. The satiny ivory cheese within is mellow, with a sweetly tangy bite and a grassy aroma. The current version features 6-point diesel, which is in limited supply, so stop by and pick up some before it's gone. And Point of Origin cheese is sold exclusively at Whole Foods Market in New York, Northern New Jersey, and Connecticut. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Hey, and welcome back to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Renee Erickson of Awaris and the Carpenter, Whale Winds. You know about Boat Street, but do you know about Shirley? Tell me about your mother.
Shirley is a force. She and my father now both run Boat Street Pickles, which is a company that I started probably 5-ish years ago while being the chef at Boat Street. We had a lot of pickles that we would make to serve with dishes there, and there was a lot of people wanting them for home, and so after many years of saying no, we finally started putting some in jars. And so, yeah, we sell 4, almost 5 varieties. We have a new one that's going to come out here this year. And the pickling thing is you know, something that I started at the old Boat Street. I had come back from France had recently eaten something that was similar to our pickled plum. And it was, you know, just an odd thing to have in general. And that it wasn't super sweet was really interesting to me. And it was served with a giant plate of you know, charcuterie. So it was something that I hadn't had before and thought was really interesting. So when I returned, we messed around with pickled plum for a long time. And then kind of, as I think most people that pickle do, become obsessed and start pickling everything. Yeah. So we have a pickle plate at all the restaurants and then it changes. It's really something that, seasonally, it's like kind of the perfect thing to have, change as you go through the seasons and then be able to kind of extend it as well. We don't jar up a lot in the restaurants just for space. But we do like giant, 5-gallon buckets of, pickled chanterelles right now and things that, in 2 months we wouldn't have. So, it's fun. It's a great way to, experiment and to be creative and kind of check out new ways of, using different spices and things without, worrying about it being good or bad. It's a fun way to play around.
So you just mentioned France, and I know that's a big influence for you because, someone who was initially energized by Rome,
right.
It's funny to see so much French cuisine in your restaurants. And when Walrus and Carpenter opened up, obviously, initially an oyster bar, but it has that bistro-esque sense to it, too.
Walrus was a restaurant that I spent many years thinking about and kind of putting together in my head, and I did. I went to France. I went to Normandy and to Paris for research. And I really appreciated the simplicity of how they could, have oysters on, virtually every corner. And it became something that was, every day versus, a special evening. And there's a beauty to how the French put together a restaurant. It's pretty spectacular. And the consistency of that, I wanted to have in our restaurant. So, having it be, lively and bright and warm, but also still kind of classic and have the focus be the oysters was the most important part. So I wanted that to be, something that people couldn't, not know was the point of coming there, to have them front and center and then in big baskets piled up was something that I felt like was kind of my version of the stand on the street. Basically.
Yeah. I mean, it's both a very local joint. Ballard is a very, local city. It's a town. I don't even know what to call it. It's community.
For sure. It's been like the bar place in Seattle forever.
So as much as going to a restaurant can be a special occasion, you wanted it to be an everyday thing. And what I love about your book is that you do kind of point out these special occasion dinners.
You
write it, you say, a Normandy dinner, New Year's Eve, but these are also everyday menus.
It
doesn't have to be celebratory to be, on the table.
No, and, part of the chapters also include many small kind of dishes that you have to sort of do a little bit more work on your own putting them together. But yeah, I mean, by no means is this supposed to be, you know, like the New Year's Eve dinner. I think we actually listed out as being, you know, something just for a party as well. But having, you know, something that you can put together without it being, you know, hours at the table versus something that's out on a lawn in, you know, July, I think is something to pay attention to as far as events. I feel like a lot of times we're, you know, we eat a lot out, I think, culturally, but we maybe aren't eating for very long. I know it's exhausting at times, but parties where you're there forever and get to really hang out with people is really important. And food, I think, is the one thing that really forces people to do that. So it's a great, great excuse.
What's on the menu for Sundays at home?
Sundays at home is the clam dish, which is, you know, I don't know. As a cook, I think you kind of go through stages of loving things and then moving away from them. And clams is something that pretty much could eat clams, you know, two or three times a week. I think they're such an easy thing to cook. They're fast, which is great. And seasonally, you can add, you know, whether it's sorrel or kale or, you know, whatever's in your garden to it to make it, you know, appropriate and easy. And then you get to have this delicious broth that you put butter or wine or, you know, creme fraiche in and a hunk of bread.
That's my favorite finish of any seafood dish I've ever, that little bit of creme fraiche that just kind of holds that sauce together.
Well, and it's rich without being over the top. You're not like dumping a cup of cream into it at the end. It has, you know, just enough kind of decadence without kind of overwhelming you. Yeah. So.
And that's what, I've been to the Whale Inns, and that's what it feels like too. It has just enough decadence, but doesn't overwhelm you. So it has this kind of stature to it, but it's so inviting.
That's good.
At the same time too. And I remember when that dish was put in front of me, and it had all those black lentils, I believe, mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah,
it's just mind-blowingly. You don't think you're an artist, but you know you are when you see a dish like that, you know, on the table.
It's, you know, that was one of the kind of aha moments for me about the book, was sort of really seeing how my education is part of what I do now versus, like, you know, it's not a literal, you know, culinary education, but like my ability to kind of like pay attention to the world and incorporate artistically that into my food is something that I don't think I notice as much until we were making decisions about the book. And I was really clear about some things, and I wanted it to be, you know, certainly more artistic than just about cooking. So, yeah, it's fun.
Tell me about the human, Jeffrey Mitchell.
Oh, the human. He did the cover for the book, and he's one of my oldest, dearest friends. And he was somebody who was my professor when I was in school at the University of Washington. And I, you know, I have a painting degree, and printmaking, but, you know, I don't know, I hope no one at my school is listening, but, you know, it was sort of a breath of fresh air meeting him at the school. 'Cause I think painting professors, at least historically at the UW, I felt, you know, there was a lot of, what you were supposed to do, you know, as far as being a painter. And it was so refreshing to meet Jeffrey, and just, you know, he can take anyone of any sort of level of talent and bring out what's best in what they do. And, you know, like, I'm probably really lucky I'm not an artist in the world, because I don't know that I would do so well. But Jeffrey has this magical way of making you believe that what you're doing is worthwhile and good and relevant. And so I, you know, thankfully am one of his friends, and he has really encouraged me and been part of my kind of growing as an artist in my career. So he, you know, it made total sense to have him do the artwork for the book, because it was, you know, kind of wrapping up all of his involvement in my life and the importance of his guidance as an actual artist.
Yeah, I mean, I see that you reciprocate that with him, but also extend it to other people you work with, like Hama-Hama mm-hmm. oysters.
Yeah,
I mean, there are amazing oyster recipes, like a grilled oyster with snail butter, but how do the two of you, you know, Hama-Hama and your restaurants kind of collaborate?
You know, I think part of being a cook is really relying on your purveyors and your farmers and the relationships you build with them. And that's, you know, maybe the best part of being a cook a lot of times is having somebody working really hard to give you the best thing for you to then sell to your guests. And, you know, oysters is something for sure, you know, you want to know who's doing it, and you want to trust that they're taking care of it and also taking care of, you know, the environment and all the things that, you know, the fallout of being a farmer is you have to be responsible to what you're doing as well. And so as a cook, you want that, is you want someone that you can trust. And I totally feel that way with Hama Hama. Local Roots is another farm in the book, and it's super satisfying to have those relationships and be able to call and ask for something to be farmed special for you, or just know that you're going to get it every Tuesday and Friday, you know.
I love one of the little tips in the book is find a boat. Like, if it's not stocking a pantry, it's finding a boat. So tell me a little bit about Warner Lou.
Warner is, so Walrus was a place that we hoped would be a place where fishermen would come so they could roll up and, you know, rubber boots and all, and sit down and have a beer and eat some oysters. And Warner was one of the many, fishermen, proper fishermen that would come in. And he, and, you know, many other people have done this as well, but he's a character. He's passionate about herring in particular, but other things as well. And he showed up, he's shown up with all sorts of things. But herring is the most, thing that has impacted our menus in the restaurants. And he brought us literally a giant lug of herring. He's like, here, you know, do something with this, play with this. And since then we now have, you know, the smoked herring that's in the book. And I've been to Alaska with him to see the herring fisheries. And it's just, you know, it's that same sort of thing where you just open up yourself to people being willing to, like, show what they love and bring it to you. And it's, you know, it's the best way to get stuff. We have people bringing urchin in, and it's, you know, you sort of can't even believe it that they're just walking in the door with a basket full of something for you as a gift. And, you know, even abalone, people have brought abalone to us, and it's fun. It's the best, you know, and it's just because you can see how excited they are, you know, especially when it ends up on the menu and they can come in and have it, you know, for dinner and tell, you know, their bosses who think they're crazy for hauling around herring in Seattle. So it's great.
But you also get to travel and explore a little bit, and you don't have to go too far to find Lummi Island.
No. Lummi is a place that Jim Hankins, who's the photographer, he has a home, thankfully, right across the beach. And we spent a lot of time there fishing and crabbing and testing recipes. And he... like recently we went to see the reef net fishing, which is a fantastic, cool way of fishing, which I had really no concept of other than seeing the gear out on the water and wondering how it actually works. But we got to go and watch it, and it's, you know, it's one of those things that is in decline as far as the, you know, it's just not as easy as dropping a gill net. So people aren't as, and it costs more. So there's lots of reasons why, you know, the gear have gone from, like, I think like 400 to 40 or something like that in the Northwest. But, yeah, I mean, 2 hours and you're on the beach, and it's crazy. So beautiful.
And one of the recipes are these stunning raw spot prawns.
That was probably one of the best days. We were out off of Susha Island, which is near Lummi and Orcas. And actually Dan, who's sitting next to me, he was spot prawning with us, and we set a trap, and I think we got one measly little spot prawn, and it was, we had to get more because we had nothing. You know, it's not like we had like a backup of spot prawns for the shoot. So we were, he was the eternal optimist, and we dropped it down and I think drank some beer and waited and ended up with a giant bucket of spot prawns, which was fantastic. But yeah, we had lime peel and some olive oil, and just, you know, it's amazing. If they come out, they're like 300 feet in the water, and when you pull them up, they start to turn bright orange, and their eyeballs kind of are like this iridescent blue, and they change like right before your eyes as they come up out of the water. And and eating a spot prawn, like, I mean, it, you know, it's sad, but fantastic. You know, yeah. It's like you take their head off and crack them open and eat them raw. And they're so sweet and have such great minerality, like, that you, I think, only get for like a minute or two probably. And then it's different. But it's one of those things that if you have a boat, you can go out and eat your own fresh spot prawn.
How clean and pure this book is, not just in its imagery, but in its recipes. reminds me of some of your favorite drinks, rosé and cider.
Yeah.
But, you know, that crispness, that's what kind of carries throughout this book, your restaurants, and all the food that you do. So it's only fitting to finish with, you know, cider and rosé.
Sure.
Wash it all down. But your birthday, that menu... It's just so strikingly clean, you know, it's so cleansing and so exciting at the same time.
Yeah. My birth, you know, it is sort of a joke now, that we call it a national holiday, even though it's not. I'm a Leo and my birthday is in August, and in Seattle, you're guaranteed sun in August. So it's always a reason to throw a big party, because you can be outside and you can invite your friends. And that was something that my parents did as when I was a kid. We would have big outdoor parties with badminton and, you know, hand cranked strawberry ice cream. And so those became, you know, something that we did every year. So I've carried on the tradition and throw big parties for myself, sort of. But really, it's just like an excuse to have, I mean, like literally 40 or 50 people together and drinking tons of rosé and eating giant big Cote de Boeufs and perfectly simple sliced tomatoes and peach cobbler, which is in the book and really one of the most delicious desserts. And really, you know, it's weirdly simple, which is one thing that I really like about the dessert is you don't have to be, you know, you don't have to make the perfect pie crust to make this work. It's really just about like really ripe fruit and just paying attention to it.
Well, even if we don't get the invite to your birthday this year, we can get the book.
For sure.
A Boat, a Whale, and a Walrus and celebrate with you every year, if not every day.
Yeah, why not?
Thank you, Renee,
Thank you so much
for being here.
Happy to be here.
Too happy for you to be here. Thank you again. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.